Nacho Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the second episode of the international break of the Calcio Land podcast. So today, I know this is a boring time of year when there's the national teams, so we wanted to bring you an episode that's mainly focused on the questions from our listeners. We have a lot of great ones. We got so many that we're going to roll over some of the questions to Monday. We have some pop culture ones at the end. And after the pop culture questions, we're going to close with an interview, a deep dive on Napoli with our friend Marco D'Onofrio. You guys know him as Cubani on Twitter. We hadn't spoken about Napoli in a little bit, so I figured this was a good time to address that. But before we get to that, I am joined by our friend, the co-host, the producer of the show, Alex Goldberg. And on Monday, Alex, I said that, you know, there's kind of like a checklist, the things that I see always happening during an international break, the transfer rumors, the Hazard ambiguous quotes on Real Madrid. I'm sure there'll be an interview with Mino Raiola coming soon. You know, the backstories on how close Messi and Ronaldo were to join a club back in the day. But the transfer rumors really reign supreme. And while, you know, in the past few weeks, we've focused almost exclusively on Serie A, we are a podcast that also talks about transfer rumors. So, Alex, I wanted to talk a little bit about two players in Serie A who have been always at the center of transfer rumors, two players that a lot of clubs want. But for different reasons, I feel like there's a little bit less buzz about them. So I'm going to ask you very simply, between Dybala and Icardi, who, in your opinion, has seen their transfer value lose the most during this season?
It's a really good question, and obviously I am just purely guessing as a fan, and I think it's close. Now, I would say Icardi has obviously taken a hit, in my opinion, for more of the drama reason, just because I'm even thinking as a Chelsea fan on why or why not I'd want Icardi to join Chelsea, and actually the main reason why I don't want Icardi at Chelsea is the drama that he brings. I know he's a really, really talented striker. He's only 26 years old, and he has proven himself to be a player that even when the rest of the team is not doing well, he can get his goals. And there's a lot of allure to that. There's a lot of value to that. A striker who can score no matter how dysfunctional the team is. He's proved that. However, I just think this year has been a little bit of a damaging year for kind of the PR side of things. You know, he's bringing Juan Dinara. He's bringing a little bit of an unknown, a little bit of a risk factor in terms of a toxicity to the club and maybe just to the dressing room. Now, I'm not saying he's a guarantee to come to your club and really ruffle everyone's feathers and things going to hit the fan, but I don't know. It's just a risk personally I don't think a team should take if they don't have an established dressing room. And that, I'm actually stealing that take from our good friend Claudio Perfetto, who hosted with me, David, while you were gone. He just kind of brought up the fact of if you're acquiring Icardi, you need to already have an established culture. So there is a risk there with Icardi. But with Dybala, it's kind of, he hasn't had a lost season, but I mean, come on. He really has not played nearly as much as you would assume someone like Paulo Dybala would. So I don't think he's not playing for the same reasons as Icardi. I mean, I know he's not. However, it's a little concerning because also with Dybala, I think it's proved this year, David, and you've pointed this out, he's tough to fit into every formation. We've talked about how Ronaldo, Mandzukic, and Bernardeschi just works way better than throwing Dybala into that formation. So I think Dybala's value taking a hit is based on, okay, well, clearly even his talent hasn't been good enough to get him in as a regular starter. And how many top teams does he just slide into their formation easily? Now, with all of that said, I've kind of given cases for both players and why their stock may drop. I think Icardi's value has taken just a wee bit more of a hit because when I look at things, especially if I'm just a neutral team and I want to acquire one player or the other, I am going to still say I'd rather Dybala. He is a year younger, not even. I mean, he's 25, Icardi's 26, so it's not a big difference at all. But I just believe that he could really still erupt at this point, whereas Icardi is still a top striker. But I feel like, if anything, because of that drama Icardi brings, maybe, and it's a little ridiculous to say, maybe we've already seen Icardi peak. So I think it's really, really close. But I would say Icardi's stock has taken a little bit more of a hit. That's my opinion, David. What about you?
Yeah, so I love the reviews from our listeners. Someone point out that they'd like to hear a little bit more disagreement, not necessarily you and I and with the guests. It's really not the style of our show, and I don't want to make it sound like I'm doing this on purpose, but I'm going to disagree here, and I put a lot of thought into this. So the age, as you mentioned, Icardi is already 26. Dybala is going to turn 26 in November. I definitely agree, Icardi. His loss of value has to do really with just off the pitch stuff, but it is substantial. You know, he is an item with Juan Danara. There's been rumors that he was maybe going to change agent. I'm not sure that's going to happen. I'd be very surprised if it happens. There is the issue that, you know, there's been serious problems with his teammates. I go back that I think a big mistake for Inter was making him captain to begin with, and you know, maybe he shouldn't have been that. Definitely, I think he's more of a follower than a leader. I think they kind of wanted him to be the symbol of Inter, but I think also he can be salvaged, and I think his role on a team is much more easy to define. You know exactly what you're going to get. You're getting a classic number nine. Also, when you look at the market for classic number nines, a lot of them are older in age. I mean, I know there's Harry Kane, there are a few exceptions, but it feels in a lot of ways the generation of the big number nines, like, they're more on the older side. The flip side for Dybala, and I'm with you, it's really role dependent. In my mind, the ideal role, and we talked about it on Monday, for Dybala is in a two-striker formation, and there's just really not that many clubs that use those. So it'll be interesting to see you know, what type of market there would be. Now, I definitely think Icardi's value has gone down. You know, there wasn't long ago that we said that his exit clause, which is between 105 and 110 million, was of good value and cheap when you looked at some of the other prices. I definitely think he wouldn't be in that. You know, I've been told from multiple people that Juve with Dybala, it wasn't long ago that they wouldn't sit down or even discuss anything if someone wasn't willing to offer 150 million. Euro. So I just don't know if there's anyone that would come to that. I mean, I'm a huge Dybala fan. I've seen him live a few times. You just see it. He really oozes talent. But I do think now there is a concern of where he fits. And again, his valuation was higher than Icardi's at the beginning of the season. So if we're looking at who has lost more on their valuation, for me, it's Dybala. And I get all the concerns with Icardi, and I think you make a really good point. Claudio had said, you know, about the culture, and he has to fit in. And, you know, it would be a place where there's a lot of strong leadership and where he's expected just to fit as a number nine. But you know what you're going to get if you sign Icardi, but I'm not so sure you can say the same about Dybala.
Let's be real. I kind of sounded a little snooty there as a Chelsea fan, like I wouldn't take Icardi. I honestly, blindfold me, I'll take both of those players. But if I had to pick, I'd choose Dybala. All right, David. Well, speaking of Icardi, what is the latest on Mauro Icardi? And what is your take on the whole situation right now?
So we're recording this early Thursday afternoon in Boston. Icardi this morning returned to Inter's practice, was with the team. He did some individual work, but was mainly with the team. I think the timing is very interesting. You know, some of the players he's clashed with, and particularly Perisic, who this week started following Maxi Lopez on Instagram, which I found to be pretty funny, are away with their national team. So it makes sense to me that Icardi would be eased in back now. So let's see how that goes. I think the big test that some of our Twitter followers pointed out is, you know, when Perisic and the other, and Brozovic and that crew is back. But when I look at the situation, and I'm really in a minority, I might actually be on an island of one right now, I still think it's more likely than not that he stays at Inter next season. From my perspective, to me, Inter has won this tug of war with Icardi completely. You look at the situation, Icardi hasn't gained anything at all by the situation. He didn't get the captain's armband. Inter is in exactly the same position in the standings that they were when he was taken off the team, which was about 5-6 weeks ago. They had the big win in the derby. His replacement, Lautaro Martinez, has been very good and has shown that he's a very different type of striker there. So from where I'm sitting, Inter won this tug of war completely. I'm of the belief that, to me, Juan de Cardi and Icardi himself, the last thing they want is to leave Inter. I think they really overplayed their hand. They tried to get this new contract extension with a higher wages. He had already gotten that for 2 years in a row. And right now there's no talk of that happening. So they gained nothing. Inter, I think, gained a lot of leverage. So if Inter wants to keep him, he doesn't have to be the captain. He's coming back with his tail between his legs. I think they've shown that maybe he has to tone down the social media stuff. We haven't totally seen that in this. If they want to sell him, yeah, we mentioned his transfer value is down. But again, you're getting a number nine who, you know, just turned 26, is just entering his prime. So I still believe it's more likely than not that he stays. I wouldn't be surprised if Inter sells Perisic and some of the players he clashed with and that he stays. I could be wrong. There's plenty of people that cover Inter and cover transfers that feel the exact opposite. But that is my guess, that Inter now has Icardi exactly where they wanted. And Juan and him, they overplayed their hand, Inter called their bluff, and they won the hand completely. So now let's move to the Twitter questions. Alex and I win every hand on Calcioland when our listeners send questions. I always say it, you guys are the co-writers of the show. We got so many good ones, as I mentioned. We're going to cover some of the ones you sent in next week. So if you don't hear your question asked, don't worry. We'll get to them next week. But as usual, you can send them in with the Calcioland hashtag. You know, we love questions on Serie A transfers, pop cultures, podcasting, journalism. Please send them our way. And Alex, which ones are we going to go over today?
All right, David, let's start off with this one. After Inter's win in the derby, do you still pick Milan to finish ahead of them in the standings?
I'm going to say yes, but it's close. You know, look, we talked about it on Monday, that to me, you know, that derby was a complete prisoner of the moment situation, as it should be. Obviously, it's a key game, very emotional for the fan bases. Inter really needed it. But, you know, Spalletti has a great track record in the derbies. Milan hasn't won a derby in quite some time. But when I look overall of the status of the teams, I'm still going to take Milan over Inter. I just think even with Icardi back, there's still a lot of X factors that come with Inter. You know, how's Icardi going to fit? Is he going to play with Lautaro Martinez or not? You know, what situation is there going to be with Perisic coming back? I know Milan in the derby didn't look good. You know, they won a lot of games where maybe they didn't play great football, but they willed their way past it. I still believe in Piontek and Paqueta and Milan's defense. So I definitely feel a little, I don't feel as good about this as I did, say, a week ago, but I'm still going to take Milan to finish ahead of Inter. What about you, Alex? Have you changed your mind or no?
No, I'm not changing my mind either. It would be an ultimate prisoner of the moment thing. I am still fully believing in what Milan has had going for them for quite some time. All right, David, next Twitter question. Assuming Inter finish in a Champions League spot, would you consider still replacing Spalletti or would you give him another chance?
Well, this question came from a longtime listener, Caballero, who covers pop culture here in Boston. He's got a lot of great content. So this, you know, it just comes down to what I often say when people asking me about sacking, keeping the manager. I always need to know who's going to replace him. If you told me that Conte is coming in there, and I still think that's the most likely outcome, I would say, yeah, I would move on from Spalletti, even say they finish ahead of Milan, you know, look great the rest of the season. I still think Conte is a better manager long-term than Spalletti. I don't know if there's really anyone who would debate that. So I would do that. If you tell me the alternative is Mourinho, then I would say, hell no, I'll keep Spalletti. Or if you told me, hey, we're going to take a chance on a Gasperini, bring him back after he had a cup of coffee at the team, someone like that, I would say, no, I would probably keep Spalletti. If you're talking Sarri, I think that kind of falls under Conte, and I would say, yeah, I would make the switch. So short of a huge name guaranteed manager, not named Mourinho, I still make the change.
All right, really good friend of the show, John Lamorta asks, is Spalletti a poor man's version of Di Francesco without European success? It seems like he can only motivate his players for the really big games in Serie A.
So I figured out that John is a Roma fan and someone who really doesn't like Di Francesco, definitely likes him a lot less than I do. I actually think this is a pretty decent analogy by John there. Like we mentioned, Spalletti is great in the derby. Gattuso has yet to really beat a really strong team. Maybe he did last season, not so much this season. But Spalletti does have a knack for this, even not even motivate the players, but maybe even Spalletti needs to motivate himself. And it seems that when it comes to the big games in Serie A, like I thought tactically what he did against Milan made a lot of sense. It surprised Gattuso. He really didn't know what to do. So I'm going to say that, John, this is a good shout out. Well played by you, John.
All right, next one, David. Do you see Gareth Bale as a possible target for Inter?
So I'm not going to be a hypocrite. I always say never write off Inter as a destination for a big name player for a variety of reasons. Now, they're based in Milan. They have a great history of signing big name players. They have good relationships with agents. But I do think Bale would be really tough just for the salary alone. I know Inter, you know, made some decent progress with Modric last summer. I got to say there was one point where I actually was like, oh my God, we might have to do a special Calcio Land podcast because this is going to go down. And then it didn't happen. But Bale earns considerably more than Modric. I think salary-wise, it's just not realistic. But again, I used to say the same thing about Juve. So it would really take Inter saying, you know what, we're going to completely overpay compared to the rest of the squad one player and do it for Bale. Now, I don't know if you do it because, you know, unlike Ronaldo, who's very sturdy, very reliable, and you know what you get with Bale, I'm not sure that you do. So I'm going to say it's not realistic that he goes to Inter. But again, I'm going to remind people that I am also the first one to say never underestimate Inter on the transfer market.
All right. Another personal question. This one comes from Sabrina Belmonte, and she asks, if Chelsea's transfer ban is upheld, will it prevent Milan from redeeming Bakayoko?
So shout out to Sabrina. Been a huge fan of the podcast. I also really enjoy her articles on Milan. Well done. So thank you for the question, Sabrina. Great to see you putting out content as well. I know you're interested in this one as well. So no, per se, the transfer ban wouldn't prevent Milan from redeeming Bakayoko from Chelsea. I think the only real impact that it would have is it makes it harder for Milan to maybe negotiate the fee down or maybe try to include a player, maybe not a swap, but kind of related. I mean, we know Suso has been linked to Chelsea. I know Chelsea's Twitter account put the Romagnoli thing. That's not going to happen. But maybe someone like Suso is not out of the question. Maybe even someone like Frank Kessie. The transfer ban would take that off the table. I also think it would make Chelsea much less reticent to even discuss a potential discount if there are no players there. But no, this wouldn't have an impact. I also have a feeling Chelsea's transfer ban will be overturned. But even if it doesn't, it doesn't change the situation. And really, the ball's all in Milan's court. As long as they're willing to pay the option to buy, which is 40 million. And look, Bakayoko's been great, but they have financial fair play concerns. The ball's completely in their court, and Chelsea really wouldn't be able to do anything about it. So related to that, Alex, I know you're much more plugged in to this. What's your gut? Is the transfer ban going to be upheld? Is it going to be overturned? Do you think Chelsea will be able to buy some players in the summer?
Well, I will say for certain, Chelsea still were a little bit surprised that after just a few days, they were immediately rejected. But that was just, they were rejected in terms of trying to get their ban suspended while the appeal's being heard. But they can still get help from the Court of Arbitration of Sport. And it does sound like either way, the appeal will be heard or decided upon before the summer. And once again, they can still get help from the Court of Arbitration of Sport. So it's really tough to guess, but I am going to lean towards Chelsea still will be able to make moves this summer. Don't quote me, I'm just a fan, but I would say it's probably 60% that Chelsea will be able to make moves this summer. But regarding Bakayoko, it really is going to depend on, of course, as you said, David, what Milan wants to do with him. But if Sarri was still in charge next year, he still just doesn't figure into Sarri's formation. If it was a whole other manager, then maybe Chelsea and Chelsea fans would want him back, but it's kind of out of their hands anyway. All right, David, next Twitter question. What are the odds that Juventus signed Matthias de Ligt, and did they make a mistake not cashing in on Rugani last summer?
So let's start with Rugani. Yeah, I think it's Juve, though, was in a tough spot last summer with the whole center back situation, because I think Milan was much more interested in Caldara than Rugani. And I think it's because they actually watched them play. And, you know, they knew that Juve had, they couldn't keep Higuain with that salary, the amortized value once Ronaldo came. So I think Milan was in a position of strength. I don't think they had much interest in Rugani. Financially, I mean, Juve has amortized almost everything of Rugani. Caldara was a nice plusvalenza based on what he was on the books for. So I think financially it would have been equivalent, but I never got the vibe that Milan was interested in him. There were plenty of reliable reports that Chelsea were interested in Rugani, and I would say more Sarri than Chelsea. I think, though, Juve, once Caldara was gone, they didn't have the stomach to get rid of another young center back. I think maybe more for the perception than the actual reality. I know there was already, you know, talk that Benatia wanted to leave, and then it happened in January. So it was a tough situation. I can understand why Juve wanted to give one more chance to Rugani. And, you know, this season he has gotten his chances. I know his hardest defenders will continue to say he hadn't. But he has, and you can't say that he's played well. And if your excuse is, well, you can't judge him when Chiellini isn't there. Well, you're also expecting him to replace Chiellini, and you're saying he can. So enough of that. You guys know how I feel on it. So long and short of it, had they gotten a big offer, I think Juve should have just done it. Trusted, even with Caldara gone, and trusted their sporting director, Paratici, to find the next Rugani or Caldara, which he might have already done with Genoa's center back Romero. Now, De Ligt is a Raiola client. That definitely helps Juve. They have a great relationship with him. I think they are a realistic destination. De Ligt has actually a while back already visited Juve's facilities in Turin and whatnot. But if I had to bet, I could maybe see Barcelona as more likely for him. It seemed they really have the end with Ajax. But I do think Juve is in the mix because they really do need a center back that can take over. It's not just even Chiellini. Bonucci is old too. Bonucci hasn't been that great defensively. So I definitely think center back is going to be a position Juve targets a lot. If De Ligt isn't realistic, I could see them going all in for Manolas, someone like that. So definitely look at Juve being very active on the market with center backs. Genoa's Romero's a nice player, but I think there'll be a bigger name that comes in as well.
You know, I have nothing against Juventus. In fact, at sometimes I've rooted for Juventus, but I would puke on my own shoes if Chelsea acquired Daniel Rugani because Sarri wanted him, and then Matthias De Ligt went to Juventus. I mean, talk about just getting the crap end of a deal. I do not rate Rugani, just like, well, I'm not going to put words in your mouth, David, but you've never really bought into all the Rugani hype. And I know Adam Digby doesn't always talk very glowingly of Rugani either. And hey, either do I. So I'm sorry, Chelsea. You can back the manager, but it doesn't mean you have to get Rugani for Sarri. All right, I'm done.
So actually, Daily Star, you can write it. David Amoyal does not rate Rugani. I got no problem if that's on the next edition.
Fair enough. All right, next one. Can you expand on your thoughts on the lack of rotation at Juventus? And are there financial reasons for this?
Yeah, so this, we mentioned it on a recent episode that our friend, as you mentioned, Adam Digby, just mentioned him. He had a nice thread on what Allegri should do and, you know, with the big lead in Serie A and just play, try different things in Serie A. You got nothing to play for. Just focus all on the Champions League. And Yanis Mikhailik, we've had on a few times as well, pointed out, well, you know, there are financial considerations because players have, you know, bonuses tied to games played and goals scored, et cetera. I mean, keep in mind, when you read the reports, you know, in the summer of a team signing a player and they're like, the wages is 3 million net plus bonuses. Those bonuses are usually tied to things like these. Also team performance, like Champions League qualification, whatnot, but a lot of individual ones. So I definitely think there's a component to that. Like, I don't know the specifics on the contracts for the players on Juve. I mean, Allegri seems to never bench Mandzukic no matter what. I'm not sure if he has more incentive than others and is getting a kickback or something like that. But I definitely think this plays a factor. I can't give you the specifics on it, but it was an interesting point by Yanis, because I got to be honest, I had never even thought of it in those terms, but it makes perfect sense.
All right. The next question is pretty cut and dry. David, will Max Allegri ever coach the Italian national team?
Yeah, I really think so. It won't be for a while, but I really think so. And I think Allegri would be an amazing tournament manager. I mean, talk about someone that can just show off his tactical acumen. I think he'd be incredible. I really think he'd be cut out of the Lippi cloth. I got to say, he reminds me more and more of Lippi. So I think it's going to happen. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon. At this point, I'm assuming Allegri's coming back to Juve. We talked about it a while ago. I didn't think so. I think everything changed between Zidane and beating Atletico. I have a feeling Allegri after Juve will have another job at a huge, huge club outside of Italy. But I do think at some point Allegri will be coaching the Italian national team. And assuming the talent is there, I'm going to say not only will he coach the Italian national team, Allegri is going to win a World Cup with the Italian national team.
All right. This next question, I have a lot to say on, but I'm glad it's not directed towards me because I would take forever. David, after the recent incident involving Ospina, do you think FIFA and Serie A will take head injuries more seriously? Would you be in favor of a fourth sub for head injuries?
The second question first, yeah. I'd be in favor of it. I mean, this is an interesting scenario, though, because you got to wonder if there would be someone maybe trying to take advantage of the situation. I'm not sure how you would, you know, specify that it's a head injury, but per se, yeah, I'd be in favor of it. And look, you know, those scenes with Ospina were really, really scary. And you and I are based in the US. We know with the NFL how much has changed, and that it's really incredible how much the NFL has changed because of what we know with the head injuries. I mean, I remember even back in the day when I used to play Madden, the video game, all the highlights, all the things to hype the game were about the huge hits players would give each other. That was really the selling point, and now that's really changed. So I do think eventually they'll start taking it more seriously. Now, do I think the NFL, the American-style football, has much bigger repercussions on concussions than European-style football? Absolutely. I mean, we know of so many former NFL players that, you know, they have huge brain damage. I've heard of maybe a couple of football players, but really not even remotely as prevalent as NFL players, but I definitely think there will be something there. So, Alex, I know you're passionate about this. Give us your cliff note version of what you feel about this subject, because you're a big NFL guy even more than me.
Yeah, and I'm glad you bring up the NFL, because I like the NFL because I just grew up on it. But I will be the first to admit it's a corrupt league. They get a lot of things wrong. They really get a lot of things wrong. The one thing they get spot on is their head injuries and how they take care of them and the research they do. Now, for a while, they didn't. For a while, it was really irresponsible on their part. But listen, they're overboard now in terms of protecting heads, concussions, etc. And they have helmets on. These footballers don't have helmets on. And yeah, I'll end in 2 seconds, but it really becomes a morality issue, David. And obviously, this listener asked about a fourth sub, because it becomes a morality issue because the manager sees the player and says, oh, he's fine now. He's fine now. He's walking to the side. He got his head stapled, or he had his head bandaged. He's fine now. He can continue. I don't want to use a sub. He's fine. It's so twisted. And it's unfair on the manager, because then the manager looks like an ass because he let the player stay in. And then like Ospina, he falls to the ground. When if you have that fourth sub and you don't punish the manager for taking off a player who just had head trauma, it really becomes a lot more something that the manager will want to do. So, yeah, I don't know what the solution is, but the whole sport needs to wake up and start taking way more consideration into the livelihood of these players. All right, David, next Twitter question. This is a little anticlimactic. Do you think De Zerbi is ready for a bigger club next summer?
So De Zerbi is a cultural land favorite. We've been talking about him for quite some time, even before he was at Sassuolo. I actually wrote this week for our friends at Euro Fantasy Game about the up-and-coming Italian managers and where they could potentially go, and he was one of the ones that I listed. I see De Zerbi as a really good fit if, say, Gasperini or Giampaolo, who are candidates for the Roma job, leave Atalanta and Sampdoria respectively. I think he slots in perfectly to a team like that, just because of the type of club, and I think that's really it's a natural progression for him from Sassuolo. Fiorentina too could be a very nice landing spot for him, because Pioli doesn't sound like he's coming back. So yeah, I think he's ready for a bigger club. You know, he's an offensive minded coach, so I think Sampdoria, Atalanta, Fiorentina culture wise are perfect for him, and I'd like to see him at one of those next season.
All right, how about this? Considering that Serie A has a full complement of Italian managers, while the Premier League has a limited selection of homegrown coaches, what effect does this have on development of homegrown players and managers?
Excellent question, and this listener had submitted it a while back, and I told him I had to think about it, and he reminded me of it. So here's the thing. I mean, Italian managers obviously have a long-term, you know, track record. I think Italian managers, you know, as good as it gets. The school at Coverciano for managers, there's really no better place. It's no surprise to me that so many of them have then moved on to the Premier League and winning them. I don't think any English manager has ever won the Premier League or even come close. I could be wrong. So I just think, you know, that's really a tradition thing or whatnot. As far as the impact on homegrown players, like, does having a manager of the same nationality really have an impact? I don't think so. You know, I could be wrong, but, you know, keep in mind, I'm also someone who really is the opposite of a nationalist. I'm really not into that stuff. So, no, my opinion, I really don't see much of a connection there between the two. You know, also England, I mean, maybe Italy now is coming back. The Italian national team talent-wise looks a lot better. But it wasn't long ago that you were like looking at the English team and be like, man, they got a lot more talent than Italy. And the managers in the league really didn't have an impact. So I'm going to say I don't really see a connection between the two. I don't know if you have extra thoughts on that. I mean, it's an interesting thought, but I just don't really see a connection. I think at the end of the day, a manager is going to play the best players at his disposal. And that's really the driving force, in my opinion, for their decisions.
Yeah, I would totally agree with what you said. I haven't really thought about that extensively, but I really do like that type of a Twitter question. I'm going to think about it now more beyond this. All right, David, this is a personal question. Uncle Sharma says, City of God is my favorite non-English language movie. What are some of your favorites in this category?
Okay, so we got a few more pop culture questions before we get to Kubani and Napoli. So if you're not into it, skip forward, bear with me, but I think you might enjoy So City of God, for those of you that haven't seen it, it's this Brazilian movie on the gangs, young gangs of Brazil. Came out, I think, about 10 years ago. Really unbelievable movie. It's kind of like a Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs in Portuguese. It's violent. It's got some great images. A really, really fascinating movie. Definitely up there, some of the best non-English language movie. So, you know, I grew up in Italy. I spent a lot of time in France as well. So I have a kind of a bias towards Italian and French movies. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of the Italian movies that I grew up with, but there's a lot of great comedies. Fantozzi with Paolo Villaggio, a movie called Allenatore nel Pallone, which is about football. And it's about a manager on a lower table team and how he discovers this talent in Brazil. It's a really, really funny comedy. So of the more recent ones of the Italian movies, one that I'd really recommend to anyone, it's called La Grande Bellezza, and it's really about the city of Rome. If you ever, you know, wonder why Totti played his whole career there, why Manolas and Zecco have stayed at Roma, like, watch that movie. It's really a love letter to the city of Rome. It's a, you know, it is plot driven, but not so much, but just the images are incredible. Of French movies, I'm going to mention two more recent ones. They did the remake in English. I think it's called The Dinner Game. In France, it's called Le Dîner de Cons. And it's about these rich guys who host these dinner parties. And the goal is to bring the dumbest person possible at the party. And it's funny, but also sentimental. I think you can kind of figure out that the dumb person that comes in that ends up being smarter than all of them and changing their perspective on life. A really good movie, much better than the American remake. And another movie who I know our friend Andrew Barker mentioned on here a while back, and it's called A Prophet. It's a prison movie, really, really good, gritty movie. This year, though, we've had some really good non-English language movies. We've talked a lot about Roma on this. It's in Spanish. It takes place in Mexico, black and white. It's on Netflix. That's probably my favorite movie in the past 2-3 years. It's in Spanish, of course. And then there's this other movie. I think it's Korean. It's called Burning. It's a really, really good movie. I'm surprised it wasn't nominated for the Oscars, so I would recommend that. If any of our listeners like any other non-English language movies, please send them our way.
All right, this next question is very interesting. I've never thought about it like this. Is Harry Potter the millennials' version of Star Wars?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a millennial. I'm a little bit older than that. I actually grew up on Star Wars, but that seems like a very good comp. I think this makes a lot of sense that it would be kind of the new thing. I mean, I've been at Universal Studios in Orlando. Like, the Harry Potter world is unbelievable. I definitely get all that. So in my opinion, I think this is a really, really good shout. I was shocked. I had totally forgotten that actually the director of Roma, Cuarón, who's I think is one of the best directors out there, even did one of the Harry Potter's movies. So I'll have to watch that one. I haven't really gotten into Harry Potter, but yeah, it sounds like it. Do you think there's kind of like a connection between Harry Potter and Star Wars as far as cultural impact?
Yeah, I would say Star Wars was still more impactful and just more big of a thing, because I think, yeah, Harry Potter became more of a sensation than Lord of the Rings. But I think at that time, Lord of the Rings was taking some of that Star Wars genre and craze. And then Harry Potter obviously had even more movies and books to it. So I think it had a little bit more longevity, especially with the kids. So I do think it's a good comp. I just think Star Wars was just so its own phenomenon and entity, and obviously still lives today in its own newer versions, that it is a little bit different. But I do like that comp because I've never really thought about it like that before. All right, David, last Twitter question. Name your 5 favorite grunge albums.
So this is probably, you know, 90s rock is definitely my favorite style of music. You know, they always say that the music you listen to as a teenager is always going to be your favorite one. And I think that's probably true, but it really was a great era of music. You know, I remember I was still living in Italy when grunge first started breaking out, but I'd spend my summers in New York because I had family there on Long Island. And, you know, one thing that I really remember so decisively is, you know, when I would come in the summer, I just loved the radio in New York. You know, we had Mike and the Mad Dog for sports radio, and I was really into that. But we also had K-Rock, the rock station in New York, and they had all the grunge albums, and I really, really got into it. So our friend Art Morelli asked me, you know, what are my favorite grunge albums? I asked him, do you mean the most influential or the ones that I like the most? And he says the ones that I like the most. So these aren't necessarily the most important ones, but the ones that I listen to the most. So you have to have Nirvana in there. Obviously, Nevermind was the album that really made grunge explode, but I actually like In Utero more. I think it's their best record. You know, I talk a lot about the Pixies on the podcast. That was really Kurt Cobain trying to make his version of a Pixies album. You have to have Pearl Jam in grunge. So kind of similar. 10, their first album is the most famous one, the one that has most of their big hits. But I really, really love Versus. I could listen to that album front to back anytime, no problem. Just really, really great record. I could pick any Alice in Chains album for this answer. I've said it many times. I think bands like Faith No More and Alice in Chains have like perfect discographies in the 90s. It's hard to find bands that have better. But if I had to pick one, it would be Facelift. Dirt is the more famous one that has Rooster on it, but Facelift, like the first half of it, like kind of feels like a greatest hits album. Almost all of those were huge radio hits. Then you guys know I love Soundgarden. Easy answer here. Bad Motor Finger, definitely their best album. I could say that's probably the best album of the 90s. That almost more of like a heavy metal album than a grunge album, but there's definitely elements of that. And my last pick, you know, they're not from Seattle, and I think in a lot of ways you'd associate grunge just with Seattle, but I'm going to pick the Smashing Pumpkins' Siamese Dream. I mean, it has all the elements of grunge songs. I have to say I wasn't a big Smashing Pumpkins fan until last summer when I saw them live, and they really, really hooked me. If we're going to disqualify Smashing Pumpkins because they're not from Seattle, I'm going to sub them with Mudhoney, who are one of the original grunge bands, even before Nirvana and Pearl Jam. And my favorite album of theirs is Every Good Boy Deserves Fudge. And all of our listeners that send in questions deserve a lot of credit. There were some great ones today. We have some more for next week. So we're going to close the show with an interview with our dear friend Marco D'Onofrio. We haven't covered Napoli in a while, so enjoy it. You know, we try to cover all the teams, so we're going to do some more on Milan. We're going to talk about the relegation coming up, but Napoli we're definitely due. Okay, and for the interview part of the segment, you know, it's during the international break. I figured this was a good opportunity to touch base on teams we haven't covered in a little while. So I wanted to talk about Napoli, and you guys know our regular for Napoli is our dear friend Marco D'Onofrio, who you guys know as Cubani7 on Twitter. We had him on last time after Hamsik's last game. So a lot has happened at Napoli since then. So this is a great opportunity to kind of get an update from Marco on this. You guys know him. He's a writer on Football Italia. He is also has a great Serie A podcast radio show called Stadio Serie A. It's coming back in April. It's been really one of the first and one of the best audio programs on Serie A. And he's also a writer on Soccer 360 Mag. Those of you who heard Marco on our show before, you guys know he's based in Toronto, though his heart is Napoletano. And before we get into Napoli, Marco, first off, welcome back to Calcio. And let me ask you, because you're based in Toronto, what's the vibe like now that Giovinco's gone? Tell me a little bit what it's like to go into games. Do you notice a big change, or what's the buzz in the city in general with that?
Well, first and foremost, Dave, thank you so much for such a kind intro. I really do appreciate it all. And you know what? There was a lot of anger when the whole Giovinco move first happened, and I think fans were really upset and frustrated, and there was a lot of question marks around the team, and with a new general manager, there was just so much speculation going on. And you know what? TFC won their first two games of the season, so things right now are smooth sailing. Pazuello, the new DP, taking over, coming over from Genk, the Belgian top flight, and he was their captain, so we've only heard good things. I can't say I've seen him a whole lot, but so far smooth sailing, but we'll see what happens if this team starts to struggle, because Giovinco definitely left a void in the city, and he was an MLS Cup winner. So it's so far so good, but we'll see what happens in the long run.
Yeah, very interesting. I'm not a big follower of MLS, but I did notice that anger on Twitter for sure. But let's talk about Napoli. So what I've been asking our guests is, you know, we're going into the last third of the season and the crucial time of the season. So I don't think it was a huge surprise that Napoli might take a step back and say, yeah, after that amazing campaign last year, they're right in the middle of things in the Europa League, and we'll get to the matchup with Arsenal in a second. But big picture wise, if you had to give a grade to Napoli this season on all their competitions, what would that be right now?
Well, coming into the campaign, I'll be very honest. I actually had Napoli reverting to third place. I thought Inter would finish second. I thought they would actually win the Coppa Italia, and I thought the goal in the Champions League would be the quarterfinals. So with that, as all things considered, I'm going to give them a B, because I think this is a club that, yeah, you know what, they're quite a ways away from Juventus, but this has been a historical Juventus side, and you know what, they're comfortably in second. Champions League elimination was definitely disappointing, but it was a difficult group. It was tough circumstances, and ultimately they were eliminated because they had less goals for. So you can't necessarily blame too much on them for that. And going into the Europa League, really this is where their season is going to lie. And that grade might change come the end of the campaign, depending on how they do in this Europa League, because that's where everything is right now. If they could, you know, get by Arsenal and have them make a deep run, then I think that grade might go up a little bit. But if they can't, then that's another story. But so far at this point of the season, I think a B is a fair grade for Ancelotti's squad.
Yeah, sounds about right to me. So now let's talk about an area where I feel Napoli always gets really high marks. And this is on the transfer market, because for a team doesn't have huge revenues, that usually has a pretty balanced budget, they really seem to do really well. And I think they hit two home runs in the summer, at least two, with goalkeeper Mire and Fabian Ruiz. So let me ask you, and this is an opportunity for you to give us maybe your two cents on both, but let me ask you this way, who has surprised you the most between these two? And I'm going to go on the assumption that this was a positive surprise.
Yeah, they've both been incredible this season, and both were big pickups. And I'm going to go with Murray right now. And the reason I say that is because Ruiz came in with a little bit of expectation, a little bit of excitement. And I know there's a few people, you know, I'll give Matteo Bonetti a lot of credit, because he said it would prove to be the biggest signing of the season. And maybe it did. And it has been. But there's a little bit of talk around him. And Murray, there was as well. And Napoli spent a pretty penny on him. But at the same time, he got hurt coming into the season. Then, you know, they had to go out and pick up Ospina, because there's a lot of question marks and there's a lot of concern. And I think in the time that we have seen him, I think he's proven to be Napoli's best goalie in ages. I mean, I honestly can't think about the last time Napoli's had a goalkeeper that you trust as much back there. And that's saying a lot. And I know he's still young. And I know there's still, again, room to grow or to revert, but at the same time, right now, he's looked pretty good. And I think he's got the faith of this club, and he's still so young. So that's why I'm going to go with him. Although Fabian Ruiz, I don't know if Hamzik's able to go, and probably let Hamzik go if Fabian Ruiz hasn't been as good as he has been.
Yeah, I'm older than you. I mean, I watched the Napoli teams that won Serie A. The goalkeeper Garella, he was good. He wasn't great. I'm going to go as far as saying Mere very likely could go down as the best keeper Napoli's ever had, and really won a position they haven't invested that much in years past, and it really goes to show what a difference he's made. So let's talk about a player that I'm down on, but it's really out of love, because I really like this player for a long time. And I have to tell you, one of my pet peeves is I really think it's very easy for fans to throw players kind of in a category. They watch them for a little bit, and then it's like, okay, this guy's a great player, and then there's some built-in excuses. But this is Diarra, and I look at Ancelotti's relaunched a lot of players on Napoli who maybe under Sarri didn't get much of a chance. So I always am excited when Diarra starts recently, and I'd say this would even go back to last season, but that wasn't as often. It kind of felt like a letdown to me. So let me get your take. Do you think I'm way off here? Am I holding him to too much of a high standard? What's your take on his performances recently?
No, I can see where you're coming from, because he's one of those players that you just keep waiting to emerge and to bust out and become the superstar that we know he can be. And we haven't seen that yet. And you're right. Under Sarri, he didn't necessarily get that opportunity, and you had big expectations under Ancelotti. And to be fair, he's had some really strong performances. It's just they haven't been consistent, and they've been too far and few in between, and that's the problem here. Because and that's probably the most frustrating thing, is because he has shown flashes of brilliance, and you can really see what he's capable of. It's just he's not doing it consistently enough, and he showed that even before with Bologna, before he came to Napoli. So I think there's a lot of potential there, and I think there's a lot of expectation. I'm not sure, and at this point, I don't know if he ever will reach that with Napoli, and maybe does he need a change of scenery? Because truth be told, if Ancelotti can't get him out of this little bit of a funk, then I'm not sure who can. But again, there's times he goes out there and he looks great. It's just it's too inconsistent. And with that said, I mean, he is still just 21 years old, so I don't think we can be too down on him, because he's 21 years old. But with that said, he's been around for quite a while, and he's not just your normal or typical 21-year-old. So fingers crossed he can emerge, but you're definitely not being too hard on the guy.
Yeah, and I know there were some offers for him in January. Not surprisingly, knowing De Laurentiis, they wanted a huge return on him. I'm curious to see what happens with him in the summer. So he's a great talent, no dispute there. We talked about Fabian Ruiz. We also have Zielinski, who's a very, very good player. So Napoli, you know, they're really great at finding these midfielders on the market. I mean, they do a very nice job at every position, but I almost feel like this is really their niche. I think basically almost all of Napoli's midfield could start for Juve. I mean, that's how good they are. So based on Napoli's track record with this, I wanted to ask you this question. You know, Allan is coming towards the end of his prime, been a terrific player for Napoli. I thought in the first half of the season was absolutely outstanding. Considering how well Napoli's their track record and their ability to potentially replace him, if a huge offer, and we know PSG had made a big offer in the summer, came around, would you really be that upset if Napoli cashed in on him, and especially if maybe it helps him keep some other players?
It depends how big that offer is, because Alan is such a critical part of this team, and we saw in the Champions League how important he was when they played against top clubs like PSG and like Liverpool. But with that said, if the reported rumors in January, PSG offering, you know, close to 100 million euros came in, then I think it's hard to refuse, because you're right. Napoli have been so good at picking up and finding midfielders. And you know, there's already reports in Italy suggesting that they signed Pablo Fornals from Villarreal. And whether that's true or not remains to be seen. But if that is the case, then clearly there's a succession plan in place. And there's an idea and something going forward. But again, that offer has to be big enough, because Alain is a crucial part of this team. But if it means that they can keep a guy like Koulibaly, then you know what? You do what you got to do, because we talked about this multiple times. And I know you're in agreement with me in saying that he might be the most important player on this team and the one guy that they can't lose. So if they got to sacrifice Alain to keep Koulibaly and they can replace him, it seems like they may already have done that, then absolutely, you got to move on. But he's not somebody you want to lose lightly, and unless you get the right offer for him, you don't let him go.
So let's close on a player that I really like. And I have to say, I'm kind of a little bit surprised, because it seems some of the Napoli fans that I follow on Twitter may not be as high on him as I am. And this is Milik, who has 15 goals in Serie A, no penalty kicks. You look at the other top strikers that have more goals, almost all of them tend to have penalties. And so I'm a big fan. So I want to ask you, I've seen, you know, some Napoli fans maybe talk about Icardi, bring back Cavani, or, you know, some big name strikers. And we know Napoli, they're shrewd on the market. They spend, but, you know, they can't spend a ton. Would you be okay with Milik still being the main striker moving forward, especially, you know, Mertens getting a little bit up in age? And also, give me your assessment of Milik's season overall, and kind of what role do you see him having at Napoli moving forward?
Well, first off, any Napoli fan that suggests that the Cardi circus coming to Napoli would be a good idea is just out of their mind. I mean, that would be a disaster, and the last thing that this team needs. And you know what? Milik is one of those players that fans love and hate, and they don't know what to do, because he's wildly inconsistent, but he's a typical striker like that. You know, he's streaky. And we've seen him miss some real sitters and at some real inopportune times. And he makes you want to pull your head out. But then he also finds a way to go under the wall and score a crucial free kick, right? So he's one of those players that has so much potential. And he's 25 years old as well. He's young. And keep in mind, he's coming off two seasons where he's had significant knee injuries. And I really do believe that had he been healthy last year, Napoli would win Scudetto, because he would have given Sarri's side just a different dynamic and something that they really lacked, because people knew that team played with the ball at their feet and they didn't have that aerial presence that Milik provides. So that was a huge difference in that Scudetto race last year. And I know he had come back in the second half of the season, but he wasn't the player, and he isn't the player that he is today now that he has had some time to get back to, you know, playing again. And so he's one of those guys that I would be okay with if he was the main striker last year or next year. Provided he has the right support and they have the depth, right? Because right now him and Mertens seem to have created a great partnership up top, and they in particularly look great playing together. So it depends who's playing alongside them, and you do want the depth. But the dream of Cavani, I don't know if that'll ever come true. I think Cavani would look great in an Ancelotti system, but it all depends on what you got to sacrifice there too. So Milik, you know, he's got the best goal-to-minute ratio in Serie A right now, scoring every 106 minutes. So that's something that doesn't get talked enough about either. So it's one of those situations where I know Napoli fans get frustrated with him, but he's got so much talent, and it'd be absurd to give up on him already.
So, Marco, it's always a pleasure to chat with you. Thank you so much for joining me today. Everyone, check out his excellent work on Football Italia. If you're into MLS and more North American coverage of the sport, Soccer 360 Mag, great place. And we look forward to you getting back on the airwaves with Stadio Serie A in April. I know it's great that you guys bring the content. You guys have been doing it for a long time. And I think when people hear you on Calcioland, they can definitely tell why you've been doing it for a long time. So thanks again for joining me, buddy. I look forward to chatting with you again very soon.
No, the pleasure's all mine, Dave. And keep up the good work on Calcioland, because you're holding down the torch and you're holding down the fort. And it's important to have accurate and reliable sources like you around. So thank you.
And that's our show for the day. As always, thank you so much for everyone who sent us questions. You guys are the best co-writers that I could possibly have. But on top of your help with the content, we also rely on you guys being the marketing department of Calcioland. This is a completely free podcast. If you enjoy what you hear, please help us grow. Please tweet links to the episode. I love seeing people, when someone asks, you know, what podcast do you like? So many of you respond Calcioland. That means a lot to me. And also, please leave a review on iTunes if you haven't already. It takes 3 seconds to leave a 5-star review. If you leave comments, Alex and I read them all, take them to heart, try to implement the suggestions. There's really no better recommendation than something coming from our listeners. So thanks again for all your support, and we look forward to chatting with you next time.